Question number one is in the name of Dr. Deborah Russell.
Fa'atalofa atu, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Finance. What reports has he seen on the New Zealand economy since Budget 2020?
Speaker.
Honourable Grant Robinson.
Talofa lava, amalo suifua, congratulations to all those celebrating Samoan Language Week this week. Mr. Speaker, the New Zealand economy is facing a 1-in-100-year global economic shock, which is why Budget 2020's primary focus was investing to protect and create jobs by supporting households and private businesses. Following the budget, international credit ratings agencies Standard & Poor's and Moody's both highlighted the strength of the New Zealand economy and the government's balance sheet. Standard & Poor's retained the positive outlook on its AA plus credit rating for New Zealand, and they expect the economy to recover faster than the budget forecasts assume due to the earlier easing of lockdown restrictions, which the Prime Minister detailed some of yesterday. Moody's also maintained its AAA credit rating on New Zealand, saying the investments in the budget would help facilitate the economic recovery. I think all New Zealanders can be proud that their actions during the lockdown to break the chain of transmission now mean that our economy can reopen faster and more jobs can be created.
What reports has he seen on the international context for the New Zealand economy since Budget 2020?
Speaker, the global economy faces a period of significant disruption as countries around the world struggle to reopen up their economies. Shortly after Budget 2020 was announced, the IMF's Managing Director, Kristalina Georgieva, warned that the global economic impact from COVID-19 will be severe and that the IMF was set to revise down its forecast for global growth next month. She said, quote, "We strongly support the extraordinary fiscal actions many countries have already taken to boost their health systems and protect affected workers and firms." She added that these bold efforts are not only in the interest of each country, but of the global economy as a whole. Even more will be needed, especially on the fiscal front. Mr. Speaker, in New Zealand, Budget 2020 got ahead of this by putting in place a plan of investments to protect workers and businesses while setting aside further money to rebuild the economy in the face of a 1-in-100-year shock.
What reports has he seen on the strength of the New Zealand economy relative to other countries since Budget 2020?
Mr. Speaker, New Zealand is in good shape to make the investments required to protect workers, grow jobs and support businesses from the worst effects of COVID-19 compared to other countries around the world. We went into this with some of the lowest government debt in the world, with net debt below 20% of GDP compared to the OECD average of around 80%. This means the government is in a strong position to support the economy during this unprecedented shock. In its report on the budget, Moody's said it expects New Zealand's robust fiscal position will remain stronger than most other AAA-rated countries and that New Zealand will have a more moderate debt burden and stronger debt affordability. Mr. Speaker, there are tough times ahead for New Zealand and many New Zealanders, but we are well placed to respond, recover and rebuild from COVID-19.
Question number two, the Leader of the Opposition.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Prime Minister. What is the Treasury's most recent estimate of unemployment in the third quarter of this calendar year, and what is the government's specific plan to arrest the sorts of job losses we've seen over the past 2 weeks?
Mr. Speaker, firstly to acknowledge Samoan Language Week, I say talofa lava to the House, and I also congratulate the member opposite on his new position as Leader of the Opposition. To answer the second part first of the member's question, we've gone hard and early on both our health and economic response. We are implementing our plan to respond, to recover and to rebuild. Treasury has forecast up to 140,000 jobs saved as a result of that plan and employment growth of 370,000 jobs supported over the next 4 years. And that is because of a range of measures, including the wage subsidy, small business loan scheme, record investment in infrastructure and so on, Mr. Speaker. In relation to the first part of the question, forecasts obviously are contained in the Budget, Fiscal and Economic Update, which is obviously publicly available and includes a high point of unemployment for the period the member asks of 9.8%, that is for September 2020, before returning to 6.4% the year following.
Supplementary. To the Prime Minister, does she accept that more direct cash support for small businesses will help prevent job losses?
Mr. Speaker, I do accept that there is a role to play for government. On that, I agree. We have, of course, placed a huge amount of emphasis on the wage subsidy, not least because small business have told us what a difference that makes for them. The vast majority, of course, then going to those with 20 or less employees. In a survey where we have just the interim results that have gone out to those who have accessed the wage subsidy, says for the vast majority it's made a difference to them being able to retain their staff. Of course, alongside that, we have had the loan scheme, which has been well accessed as well by small business. That is interest-free for the first year. And I am hearing anecdotal evidence that some small businesses are taking on that extra buffer, not necessarily because they need it immediately, but just to provide that extra certainty over the next 12 months. I add to that, of course, the work that we're doing, investing in putting cash back through our tax system, through IRD, and of course within the budget we also had a number of programs around e-commerce, which I could happily go into.
Supplementary. Why has the government not delivered any direct cash support to small businesses other than the wage subsidy or more debt to reduce the number of job losses?
Mr. Speaker, I would dispute the premise of that member's question.
Supplementary. To the Prime Minister, could she please inform the House where, over the last 3 months, has she provided direct cash support to small business owners?
Mr. Speaker, the wage subsidy scheme has put out over $5 billion directly into small businesses. And Mr. Speaker, it is the most significant part of that wage subsidy scheme. I would also add to that, Mr. Speaker, the work that has gone into tax carryback, loss carryback through IRD, that has improved cash flow as well. Many small businesses will be able to access that as well. Mr. Speaker, that is just a small handful of the initiatives that we've put in place to help with cash flow for small businesses immediately.
The Prime Minister is saying that, unlike some, she and her government see businesses as being not just the owner or the boss, but the staff, being critical as well to any business enterprise.
Mr. Speaker, my strong takeaway from the period at which I both worked in small businesses but also as a small business spokesperson was that small businesses do see their staff, and I know the member will agree with this, small businesses do see their staff as their family. And in fact, the number of letters that I receive from small businesses saying the fact we prioritised the wage subsidy meant a huge amount to them because one of their biggest concerns was, of course, the ongoing cost of payroll, and hanging on to their workforce meant a huge amount to them.
Supplementary, I'll ask the Prime Minister again. In addition to the wage subsidy, which goes directly to the workers, which is fine, what direct support has gone to the small business owners?
Mr. Speaker, I would again re-emphasise that the wage bill for small businesses is one of the most significant costs, outside, of course, things like rental costs. And, Mr. Speaker, keeping in mind that many businesses are now operating again, this support continues to make a huge difference for that fixed cost of their staff. Alongside that, Mr. Speaker, we have, of course, through our tax system, billions of dollars enabling small businesses to access refunds now to help with cash flow.
Supplementary.
Before the member goes on, I just want to remind all his absent that while the Leader of the Opposition is asking his series of questions, his mic is open and her voice is coming through it very, very strongly.
Supplementary to the Prime Minister. What proportion of small to medium-sized businesses over the last 2 months have experienced negative cash flow?
Mr. Speaker, I would be happy to answer where we have the data available. Where we have the data available, such questions, our survey work that we've put out may give us some insights. But what I can tell you from the interim results is that well over 80% have said the wage subsidies made a difference to them keeping their doors open.
The Honourable Stuart Nash.
We're aware of the $29 million of consultancy services through the Regional Business Partner Network that has been accessed by thousands of businesses up and down this country.
Absolutely, Mr. Speaker. And the member wouldn't want to be members would not wish to be dismissive about something that we are getting incredible feedback from. Those services are providing business support and advice on the ground around payroll, around reducing fixed costs, around consultancy services to access the money that they are able to access through IRD without having to use accountants that they may not be able to afford.
A point of order, the Honourable Grant Robinson.
Mr. Speaker, I have noticed over the course of this question that you have reinstated your questions being taken off and added that you hadn't been in the last couple of weeks, and it might just be valuable for members on all sides of the House to know you've reinstated your scoring system.
I want to thank the member to indicate to him that in the previous couple of weeks, members were generally better behaved than he's been today.
David Seymour.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Does the Prime Minister agree with Treasury's estimate that spending the full COVID-19 response and recovery fund would save about 30,000 jobs a year compared with Treasury's baseline forecast?
Well, Mr. Speaker, the member is correct that the forecasts that were relied upon in the budget did allow for around $20 billion worth of the fund to not be spent over the forecast period. Of course, their predictions are that if the full recovery fund is spent over the forecast period, we see growth returning by next year. We see unemployment back down to the rates it was pre-COVID within the next 2 years. So that demonstrates that that level of investment will make a difference. Where I caution the member is, of course, we don't want to prescribe the answer before we know what the biggest difference we can make will be with that refund. And I've seen many commentators supporting the approach of the government and what we've taken in that way.
David Seymour.
Does she then agree that this represents nearly $260,000 of taxpayer funding for each job saved?
Mr. Speaker, again, I think that's an overly simplistic analysis. And of course, taking into account that Treasury themselves have endorsed an approach of investing versus austerity and of generating the kinds of job that the budget package does, which is in the number of over 370,000 of which.
Supplementary. Does she accept that businesses with high levels of debt and who are yet to receive direct cash support other than the wage subsidy will be most likely to be letting workers go?
Mr. Speaker, again, the survey work suggests that actually the wage subsidy has made that difference. I can see that the member is advocating for straight grants. We made a deliberate decision that wasn't where we were going, and let's be just open and honest about that. Instead, we have targeted through the wage subsidy, we have used interest-free loans, and we have worked very hard to support those businesses which may be vulnerable but are viable. We've also said this is a 1-in-100-year global pandemic. We will not be able to support and save everyone. But thus far, Mr. Speaker, looking at our job seeker numbers relative to other countries, yes, we're seeing a hit, but not nearly the scale in some other places.
Supplementary. So is the Prime Minister saying to the House that what small to medium-sized businesses need right now is not direct cash support? Is that what she's saying to the House? No cash support is what small businesses are asking.
Mr. Speaker, I have acknowledged that we did not implement a generic grant scheme, keeping in mind that we saw that on a small scale in Australia, and they have seen a higher rate of individuals going on to their version of JobSeeker than what we have. So they took a different path. They also took a month to pay out their equivalent of the wage subsidy. We got ours out the door within 5 days. So yes, we took a different approach, but we stand by it. And it has never been about one answer. It's been about multiple support mechanisms for small businesses. And we believe that there will be more to do, but that is the path we have chosen.
Supplementary. So what does the Prime Minister say to the businesses of Papamoa and around the country who say in the single voice, we need more cash now to survive or our people go?
Mr. Speaker, again, I'm speaking not only from the anecdotes that the member's speaking to as well. I have received emails, I've talked to small businesses, I've seen the survey results. The wage subsidy, the member should not discount the impact that it has had in keeping the doors open. The member obviously advocates general cash payments. We have decided to be more targeted. We stand by that decision and we will continue to look for other avenues to keep up that support for small business.
Supplementary. The Honourable David Parker.
Can the Prime Minister confirm that sole traders receive that wage subsidy for themselves?
Absolutely. Mr Speaker, again, 54% of those who have applied are made up of the self-employed. Small businesses, 44%. So the total small business and self-employed, in terms of numbers, equates to 97%. That is vastly who has been supported. And again, as I say, interim results from those surveys, but it suggests not only have they kept their door open, but the vast majority have been able to prevent job loss as well. And that's what many were seeking.
To the Prime Minister, on behalf of the 500,000 small businesses in New Zealand, would the government consider adopting National's proposal to give businesses direct cash support in the form of GST cash refunds of up to $100,000 to help them cover their ongoing fixed costs?
Mr Speaker, I notice other members of his party have been quite dismissive during this question time of using the tax system to get cash flow to small business. So perhaps not everyone is of one voice. But again, the tax loss carryback scheme, $3.1 billion. Tax loss continuity support, $60 million. Tax deductions for assets, again, a massive part of our first tax package through Minister Nash. We raised the provisional tax threshold. We allowed depreciation on buildings, and we also have allowed loans for R&D intensive businesses as well. That's before we get into the $10 million for e-commerce, the $13 million for the digital economy, and also the NZTA work. Again, we've used the tax system too.
The Right Honourable Winston Peake.
Has the Prime Minister received any reports that the so-called throw cash at the problem 100,000 was announced by the previous leader of the National Party, whereupon they threw him out?
Order. Order. Well, the member knows that there's no responsibility for it. You might be here for politics, but I think you also know that you have to get some prime ministerial responsibility. And neither the announcement of the previous leader of the opposition or what happened to him are directly the prime minister's responsibility. Question number three, the Honourable Tracy Martin.
Mr Speaker, to the Minister for Regional Economic Development, how has the Provincial Growth Fund been refocused to aid the post-COVID-19 recovery?
The Honourable Shane Jones.
Speaker, three particular principles have been refined. Number one, jobs. Number two, pace and timelines. And number three, visibility. Unfortunately, a number of the projects were hampered and hobbled by statutory consent problems. Those will be dealt to by David Parker when he revamps the RMA and brings a proposal back to the House. And then we'll see about the attitude from the other side of the House. $100 million, sir, has been made available to work with Regional Council and the farmers who are looking towards the champion of the provinces to assist them with riparian planting and waterways. $60 million for rail investments and roads, and $70 million in direct response, sir, to the leaders of our local communities to address issues such as refurbishing town halls, war memorials, where appropriate, marae, provided that they're free of iwi ideology.
Mr Speaker, to the Minister, how will the projects announced following the refocusing support these goals?
Speaker, obviously waterway improvement is something that society through the last election called for loud and clear. There are sensitive waterways in areas such as the Kaipara Harbour. Regional councils have become hoarse over the previous nine years waiting for assistance, and it has now arrived through the Provincial Growth Fund. Further decisions and announcements pertaining to water quality that will augment what we're doing are no doubt going to be announced in due course. Local roading projects, which do not require the long-term process of NZTA to be observed, they can start with alacrity, and rail projects, given that this government is the saviour of Kiwi Rail, are ready to go and are likely to create hundreds of jobs.
Mr Speaker, to the Minister, why is this change in focus necessary for our provinces?
These changes will be a welcome source of relief for the breadwinners in the breadbasket of New Zealand, otherwise known as the provinces. As those areas that were dependent on tourism, and as we've seen the loss of foreign exchange earnings into the many billions, we need now to work with provincial businesses. We need to work with those stakeholders to ensure that they are able to make tough decisions that grow productivity. The framework and the relationships that we've created through the Provincial Growth Fund will enhance their ability to perform, and they are waiting with great anticipation to the soon-to-be-announced $3 billion infrastructure funds.
Question number four, the Honourable Paul Goldsmith.
Ngāti Epsom.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Order.
Order.
Was it one or two members who interjected then? Mr. Jackson as well? Both blaming each other. Both will stand, withdraw and apologise.
Withdraw and apologise, Mr. Speaker.
And Mr. Jones.
Withdraw and apologise. Ngāti.
No.
Look, this is a matter that's had some publicity, and it's an error made by a Member of Parliament, and my view is that it should be left there. And frankly, I would have thought that the senior member from the North should have, or the relatively senior member for the North looking in front of him, should know better. He will apologise again.
Draw and apologise, sir.
Point of order, Speaker.
A point of order, the right honourable.
Mr. Speaker, I think it's of some moment to anyone in this country who's been here in their ancestry 1,000 years, who is Maori, that people are actually identified to be either that or not. It's not a matter of racism or anything else, but I think it's a legitimate thing to raise in this House when someone has the, ignorance to say that someone is Maori and that person himself says he's not. I think sorting it out in this House is pretty important. It may be of some embarrassment, but that's no reason why we should avoid the silliness which I've seen in other countries where someone was named, as you recall, Pocahontas because of a claim to be Indian. Now, if it's still drumming around in the American political system, surely we can have our day of fun.
Okay. And I'm sure that later in the afternoon, when we get on to the debate, there will be an opportunity for something which is slightly wider. In the interim, I could recommend to people that they read a very good paper from the Minister coordinating race relations in about 2005, which drew attention to the indigeneity of someone from Wainui Mata.
Paul Goldsmith.
My question is to the Minister of Finance. Does he have confidence in the Treasury's budget forecast?
The Honourable Grant Robertson.
Tēnā koe, Mr. Speaker.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Yes, I have confidence that the Treasury undertook the same rigorous independent process to...
Thank you, Mr. Goldsmith.
...as it did under the previous government. And I note that Treasury this year undertook the unprecedented step of updating its economic and tax forecasts closer to the budget. I would add that most economists, from the Treasury to retail banks to the Reserve Bank, have said that forecasting during a 1-in-100-year global economic shock is difficult, and as I said in the budget speech, more of an art than a science, which is why Treasury, of course, produced three alternative scenarios alongside its central budget forecast.
On what basis does he have confidence in the Treasury's forecast that the economy will generate 180,000 new jobs in the next 2 years?
Speaker, I believe the member is quoting from the analysis by Infometrics economist Brad Olson. He was actually comparing job creation and the unemployment rate together, which, as the member knows, is a tricky area to go into. What we do know is that the investments that the government is making in job creation and helping people stay in the jobs undoubtedly will add to job growth.
Does he agree with Professor Norman Gemmell's observation that Treasury's estimates that $62.1 billion COVID spending will save 140,000 jobs? That's nearly $450,000 per job saved.
Mr. Speaker, it's really a repeat of the previous answer. Forecasting in this environment is very difficult. Norman Gemmell has been a fairly regular critic of the work of this government, so it doesn't entirely surprise me he's made those comments.
I mean, does he agree with Professor Gemmell's conclusion that $450,000 per job saved sounds like an expensive trade-off?
Mr. Speaker, I don't actually agree with the premise of Mr. Gemmell's comments, let alone his conclusion.
Does Treasury's forecast that tax revenue will return to pre-COVID levels by 2022 rely on the imposition of new taxes?
Mr. Speaker, no, it doesn't, and the member will be aware that Treasury's forecasts rely upon their idea of where the economy will be at any given moment. I would note for the member that actually Treasury's forecasts are more pessimistic in a number of ways than the average of the retail bank's forecasts. So it just highlights that at the moment we are in the middle of a 1 in 100 year shock, but the government's plans to grow jobs and keep people in jobs will stand us in good stead for growth in the future.
Could I follow up on the Honourable Paula Goldsmith's question and ask whether or not it's a fact? Well, that's just an interpretation. Whether or not it's a fact that Treasury actually, if you know anything about Treasury, make their forecasts on existing tax law, not some futuristic dreamt-up tax law.
Leaving out the out-of-order bit.
Well, Mr. Speaker, Paula Koremete's comments I don't agree with.
Paul Goldsmith.
Does indeed, as the member suggests, make their forecasts based on existing policies.
Supplementary. Will he rule out tax increases in the next term of government if he is fortunate enough to be the Minister of Finance?
Mr. Speaker, I can say that this government's record on taxation stands. We have made sure that over the last 2 months we have used the tax system to put in place measures that support the cash flow for small businesses in New Zealand and to support all New Zealand taxpayers. Mr. Speaker, on that score, the government stands by its tax policy. Future governments will make tax policy as they see fit.
So can he confirm that if re-elected, he will send New Zealanders the invoice for the spending that is happening now?
Mr. Speaker, no. What I can confirm that the member's confidence in the re-election of this government is well placed.
Question number five, the Honourable Louise Upston.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Social Development and asks, does she believe all her recent announcements are fair and non-discriminatory?
The Honourable Carmel Sepuloni.
Mr. Speaker, Talofa Lava. I believe the decisions this government has made will support New Zealanders to get back on their feet after the impacts of COVID. These announcements include the COVID-19 income relief payment, which will support families who have experienced a job loss due to COVID-19, the wage subsidy, which has supported 1.6 million New Zealanders, and the $150 million we are putting into expanding MSD's employment services. Alongside this, our government is committed to an overhaul of the welfare system to ensure it is fair and non-discriminatory. That's why on the 1st of April we indexed main benefits to increases in wages, increased benefits, lifted abatement threshold, and removed the discriminatory sanction that penalised sole parents. Max Rashbrook, editor of Inequality New Zealand, summed up his piece by saying, "The COVID-19 payments, far from being an insult to the already unemployed, are not just a sensible way to cushion the blow of a colossal economic shock. They could be a step on the way towards a welfare system that genuinely and generously helps us collectively insure against the social risks that are far too large for any one individual to manage."
Has she received specific legal advice around whether the COVID-19 income relief payment unfairly discriminates between individuals?
Mr. Speaker, to my knowledge, there is no discrimination. However, drawing distinctions in order to decide who can receive taxpayer-funded income support is an important and legitimate policy decision for any government. We supported, Mr. Speaker, the job loss cover that was put in place following the Canterbury earthquakes under the previous government. We also supported the restart package that was put in place following the global financial crisis, Mr. Speaker. Unprecedented events call for unprecedented actions, and it's important that we act urgently to ensure that families are looked after during this time.
Does someone who lost their job on the 29th of February have lower living costs than someone who lost their job on the 1st of March? And if not, why will they receive less money?
Mr Speaker, it's important to note that on the 1st of April, indexation of main benefits came into effect. That was probably one of the most significant moves that we've seen with respect to the welfare system. It'll also mean, Mr Speaker, that they will be better off. If we look at a sole parent, for instance, Mr Speaker, they would have received an additional $10.56 from indexation, an additional $25 on April 1st from the increase in benefits. Also, if they had a sanction applied, Section 192, an additional $34 on average. Mr Speaker, we are responding to the recommendation in the Welfare Expert Advisory Group's report to overhaul the welfare system. Alongside that, Mr Speaker, we are putting measures in place to respond to this unprecedented event.
The Right Honourable Prime Minister.
Supplementary, can the member confirm that the income support measures that were announced yesterday were modelled on the very changes that the last government made in the wake of the devastating Christchurch earthquakes, a policy which it now seems the past the opposition no longer supports?
Order, order. The member may ask. Answer the first part of the question.
Yes, Mr Speaker, I can. As I said, there has been a precedent of this in the past when we have faced other situations which, of course, could be deemed a crisis. This one, though, Mr Speaker, I do need to say, is at obviously a much larger scale. We're not talking about one particular region, although we obviously recognise the significance of the Canterbury earthquakes. And so, Mr Speaker, I think that this is the responsible action to take. I stand by it, as does our government.
Does she accept that when the government rightly closed the New Zealand's borders to China on the 2nd of February, many tourism workers lost their jobs due to COVID-19? And if so, why are they being discriminated against and not able to access the COVID-19 income relief payment?
Mr Speaker, 1st of March till October 30 is when this will be open for those that may have lost job because of the impacts of COVID-19. As I said, also, I am relieved that this government has taken action quickly, keeping in mind that our first response, I think, with regard to COVID was to increase benefits and double the winter energy payment, Mr Speaker. Is there more to do with respect to the welfare overhaul? Absolutely, and this government's committed to doing more.
Does she think it's kind that someone with a permanent disability on the supported living payment will now receive less financial support from the government than a job-ready worker with a $20,000 redundancy package and a partner earning $2,000 a week?
Mr Speaker, can I just say that I find that quite rich, given that even when the opposition were in government and they did lift benefits, they only lifted benefits for those that had children. They had no regard for those that had a disability or a health condition. When we lifted benefits on the 1st of April, they were for all benefit recipients. We took into consideration that actually 136,000 of those on benefits did have a health condition or disability, and we ensured that that benefit increase went to them as well.
Question number six, Priyanka Radhakrishnan.
Talofa lava, Mr Speaker, in recognition of Samoan Language Week. My question is to the Minister for Social Development. What recent announcements has the government made on providing financial support for people who have lost work due to COVID-19?
Talofa lava, Mr Speaker. Yesterday we announced the COVID-19 income relief payment to provide support for people who have lost work since March due to the impacts of COVID-19. Like Australia, the UK and many other countries, we can't escape the reality that there will be job losses and people's lives will be affected. The measures we have taken to protect jobs and help businesses stay afloat against the impacts of COVID-19 are significant. But unfortunately, Mr Speaker, unemployment will rise before it improves. As with the GFC and the Canterbury earthquakes, widespread redundancies were expected and temporary financial assistance was introduced to reduce the impact on those who lost their jobs. The COVID-19 income relief payment will help cushion the blow for families who have experienced an unexpected job loss due to the economic impacts of COVID-19. This payment is part of our next step to help New Zealanders respond and recover during these unprecedented times.
Supplementary. Who will qualify for the COVID-19 income relief payment?
Mr. Speaker, the COVID-19 income relief payment will help reduce the negative impact of job losses on individuals and families. We know that many people who may be faced with job loss might not qualify for a benefit. In ordinary times, we'd expect many of these people to quickly find other work or manage their costs over time without additional support. However, the unprecedented times we face mean many of these families and individuals will be under pressure to get back on their feet quickly to meet their living costs, but will be doing so this in a different labour market than they have faced before. These are extraordinary times, and there is a growing cohort of people not eligible for the benefit but also facing the global economic impacts of COVID-19. This payment will provide a cushion for up to 12 weeks for people who have lost a job or a business since the 1st of March and up until the 30th of October and whose partners earn under $2,000 per week.
Feedback has she heard on the COVID-19 income relief payment?
Mr. Speaker, we have received support for our announcement from a diverse group of stakeholders. Business New Zealand said yesterday in their press release, "We are glad to see the government cushioning the blow and protecting jobs where possible and supporting workers back into jobs where necessary." The New Zealand Council of Trade Unions said they support this initiative to really make sure that those Kiwis who are out of work are actively assisted to find new work while being financially secure. There has also been some criticism about this payment and what this means for our welfare overhaul. I want to confirm that we are still committed to continuing our welfare overhaul and improving support for New Zealanders who interact with our welfare system. We have made significant changes to date, including indexation of main benefits and benefit increases. Is there more to do? Yes, and we are committed to continuing this work.
Question number seven, the Honourable Michael Waterhouse.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Health. Has he received any advice regarding the number of surgical procedures that did not take place as planned due to COVID-19? If so, what is his best estimate of the number of these procedures?
The Honourable Dr. David Clark.
Talofalava, Mr. Speaker. Budget 2020 included a one-off investment of $282.5 million. To fund a planned care catch-up campaign following disruption caused by the COVID-19 global pandemic. That will fund an estimated 153,000 surgeries and procedures, radiology scans and first specialist appointments over the next 3 years. Preliminary data suggests that approximately 8,500 elective and acute inpatient surgeries were deferred and 11,100 minor procedures. I'm advised that the Budget 2020 funding will more than cover that level of deferred care.
Does he agree with Sarah Dalton of the Association of Salaried Medical Specialists, who said, quote, "The health system will absolutely not be able to relive the backlog in a year, no way in the world," end quote.
Mr. Speaker, I think what we've seen during the COVID period is an extraordinary response from our health system. People have been willing to step up and deliver care in new ways. I expect that people will be working as efficiently as possible to deliver as much care as possible.
Is he saying by the budget numbers that there will be a net increase of 120,000 to 130,000 elective procedures next year? And if so, why will he not publish data to confirm or refute that?
Mr. Speaker, I think the member misunderstands. There are, of course, a number of components of those surgery and procedures, radiology scans and first specialist assessment appointments that are accounted for in the 153,000 surgeries and procedures, radiology scans and first specialist appointments that have been funded over the next 3 years by the government in the budget. It is a significant investment, make no mistake. And also, we do note that the hospitals are having to work in different ways, allowing more space, extra cleaning routines and so on because of COVID. But we are prepared to invest in our health system. It has been underinvested in for a very long time, and we will continue to invest. That is the record of this government.
will there be a specific quantitative target of elective procedures for 2020-21, and if not, why not?
Mr. Speaker, we have seen more planned care for more people under this government, and that is what we are absolutely focused on. Mr. Speaker, targets don't treat people. Well-resourced doctors and nurses treat people. And under this government, we have 1,500 more nurses, we have 900 more doctors, and we have over 600 more allied health workers. After 9 long years of neglect, the health system is getting the resources finally that it needs to provide the care that New Zealanders need and deserve.
To the Minister, if he is so sure that as a consequence of this investment more will be done, why will he not publish the data that confirms this?
Mr. Speaker, we continue to publish data that shows more care is being received by more people. That is the record of this government.
Question number 8, Marama Davidson.
Mr. Speaker, thank you.
Does she believe our social system support should provide enough income for all people to live with dignity?
Mr. Speaker, yes, I do agree, and that's why this government has already taken steps to increase income for New Zealanders. We implemented our families package, which was the biggest boost in household income in a decade for thousands of families. In Budget 19, for the first time in New Zealand's history, we indexed main benefit increases to wages and also removed the punitive sanction 192. And this year, we have increased main benefits and doubled the winter energy payment. It is important to note that support for employment and access to upskilling and training were also cited by the Welfare Expert Advisory Group as being of the utmost importance. So this government's investment of $1.6 billion into the Trades and Apprenticeship Training Package and the $150 million extra into expanding MSD's employment support is also crucial. We have always said that we couldn't make all the changes we wanted to in 1 year or even in one term, but this government will continue to work together on how we can improve income support for New Zealanders.
Is the COVID-19 income relief payment announced yesterday a recognition by this government that current benefit levels are too low?
Speaker, this payment is temporary financial assistance in recognition of those New Zealanders impacted by job losses due to COVID-19 that may not be, in some instances, eligible for support in our current welfare system and or find themselves unemployed at a time where the labour market is going to be much more difficult to navigate. This payment is one of a range of financial assistance initiatives the government is providing to New Zealanders. There is also further work underway to explore unemployment insurance schemes following a request from Business New Zealand and the Council of Trade Unions. This government is exploring how to best support displaced workers, and unemployment insurance is a key tool many countries in the OECD use for that purpose. We want to understand the role it can play in New Zealand on top of the work we are already doing to improve income adequacy through the welfare system.
Should people with health conditions and disabilities be able to keep their full benefits when they enter a relationship with someone earning less than $2,000 a week, just like people who will be receiving the COVID-19 temporary income payment?
Mr. Speaker, one of the key parts of this government's medium-term welfare overhaul plan is to review the settings underpinning income support, including, for example, relationship settings and eligibility criteria. And I look forward to us continuing to do that work together.
What further work is being done to ensure everyone in New Zealand has enough to live on, both during this crisis and long-term?
Mr. Speaker, under our confidence and supply agreement, we committed to an overhaul of the welfare system, and we're already seeing positive impacts for people as a result of this government's achievements. For example, for a person receiving sole parent support with a six-month-old, no other income, living in South Auckland, increases under this government have meant a total increase of around $200 per week compared to a person in the same situation in early 2017. In response to COVID-19, we have also implemented the wage subsidy, which has supported more than 1.6 million employees through lockdown, developed a small business cash flow loan scheme, injected $27 million into the social services sector, and invested a further $30 million through CDEM into helping those with immediate needs around food and welfare. But I've never shied away from the fact that we have more to do in the long term to address income adequacy. We will continue our work to overhaul the welfare system to support the wellbeing of New Zealanders now and into the future.
Question number 9, Chris Bishop.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the Minister of Transport. On what date did Cabinet last consider the Auckland Light Rail project, and when does he expect to make an announcement as to a preferred delivery partner for the project?
The Honourable Phil Twyford.
Talofa lava, Mr. Speaker. Ma lua sui fua. 4th of June and after Cabinet decides.
Sorry, 4th of June 2018 or 2019?
Well, Mr. Speaker, I think it's self-evident because we haven't got to 4th of June this year, and the most recent 4th of June that I'm aware of is in 2019.
Why has Cabinet not considered Auckland Light Rail since the 4th of June, as we've now learned, 2019, when the government committed to having it built to Mount Roskill by 2021?
Because I haven't taken that proposal to Cabinet yet, and the reason is that it was due to go to Cabinet in February after the Ministry of Transport completed a rigorous assessment of alternative proposals that Cabinet asked it to do. And at the time that COVID-19 hit the country, we've incurred a delay of 3 months because the government has been preoccupied with focusing all of its resources on the response to COVID-19. But the proposal will return to Cabinet shortly.
Is he seriously telling the House that COVID-19, which only really came into effect in terms of government timelines in the last 3 months, is to blame for 3 years of inaction on a core government election promise?
Well, I completely reject the premise of the member's question.
What premise of my question does he reject?
That there had been no work done over the last 3 years.
Can he confirm officials recommended to him that a refreshed process would have allowed market participants the opportunity to bid for the delivery of Auckland Light Rail? And if so, why did he not progress this option?
I can't confirm that, but I can confirm that the Ministry of Transport and Treasury advised Cabinet that the twin track assessment process that the Ministry of Transport completed in the last 6 months of the last calendar year was justified and the appropriate way to deal with the options that were on the table.
Is he aware that the Deputy Prime Minister has just said this afternoon, quote, "It's not an issue for us because it's not going to happen in the immediate term," and will he now accept that Auckland Light Rail is not happening?
Look, discussions among coalition partners are an essential part of Cabinet decision-making. We've had those discussions, and they will be reflected in the advice that goes to Cabinet.
Question number 10, Dr. Liz Craig.
Talofa lava, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Research, Science and Innovation, and asks, what recent announcements has the government made about a vaccine strategy for New Zealand?
The Honourable Dr. Megan Woods.
Talofa lava, Mr. Speaker. Today, the Deputy Prime Minister, the Minister of Health and I announced the COVID-19 vaccine strategy. The COVID-19 strategy aims to secure a vaccine safe, effective and in sufficient quantities at the earliest possible time. It will enable New Zealand scientists to ramp up their important research, allow New Zealand to contribute to global research efforts and explore the potential of vaccine manufacturing capability in New Zealand. We've set aside $37 million as part of the strategy, which will see New Zealand collaborate on the development of diagnostics, vaccines and treatments of COVID-19. The development of a vaccine is an immense global challenge, and the government's approach is recognition that this will take time, cohesion and expertise from across the board, from homegrown science capability to the leading role New Zealand will take in the Pacific in the distribution of the vaccine once it is discovered.
So what are the key components of the strategy?
Mr. Speaker, there are five central pillars to this strategy which acknowledge the complexity and interconnectedness of the vaccine challenge. The pillars are connecting New Zealand researchers globally to contribute to all aspects of vaccine development, distribution and use, investing in research that contributes to global efforts, build relationships and supports early access to a vaccine, developing the ability to manufacture in case it is needed to secure supply, and optimising regulatory approaches to ensure safety, support, research and enable domestic manufacturing, and using our purchasing arrangements managed by Pharmac to secure supply where possible to enhance resilience. The vaccine strategy will also feed into and support immunisation strategy and planning as safe and effective vaccines are developed.
So what role will the New Zealand research sector play in the production of a vaccine?
New Zealand has a world-class research sector with a history of working with colleagues across the globe to tackle complex problems. I've been heartened to see the speed and enthusiasm with which researchers have been tackling this issue, and it is this expertise that will be crucial to New Zealand securing access to a vaccine as soon as possible. It is vital that we contribute to international research efforts as well as ramping up our own research and manufacturing capability to meet demand. New Zealand scientists and researchers have already initiated early work into vaccine research, and we've supported this through funding through the COVID Innovation Accelerator Fund. I'm pleased to say this strategy will enable this valuable New Zealand research to continue.
Question number 11, the Honourable Todd. Oh, sorry, Liz Craig.
Just one final sup. So how will New Zealand play a part in assisting our Pacific neighbours?
Speaker, we also have a strong interest in ensuring access for Pacific Island countries. Our aid program will work with Pacific Island countries, regional organisations and other donors to help these countries access vaccines and implement successful immunisation strategies. This is consistent with New Zealand's ongoing commitment to the Pacific, and I'd like to thank the Minister of Foreign Affairs for his ongoing advocacy for the Pacific region and its part in the broader vaccine strategy.
Question number 11, the Honourable Todd McLean.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the Minister of Tourism, does he stand by all his statements and actions in relation to tourism?
The Honourable Kelvin Davis.
Yes, in particular, I stand by my announcement on Budget Day, which delivered a $400 million tourism recovery package targeted at helping businesses pivot towards the domestic market and protects our strategic tourism assets and the communities that benefit from them. This package, coupled with the extension of wage subsidies, our domestic marketing campaign, business tax relief and the business finance guarantee scheme, forms this government's strong support package for the tourism sector, which will help us all to respond, recover and restart the tourism industry in a post-COVID world.
So the Minister, what does he say to Hoverton Chief Executive Russell Alexander, who said that there has been no detail in the government tourism response package, and the problem is we have a Minister of Tourism who is talking at his industry, not talking with or for his industry?
Mr. Speaker, I have received a letter of apology from the very same person following their remarks, which were taken out of context. I have accepted their apology. And he also said a $400 million support package is significant and welcome, as is the wage subsidy relief extension.
To the Minister, as Minister, what is his personal plan to get tourism back on its feet?
So, Mr. Speaker, firstly, our plan involved a strong and urgent government response to support workers in small tourism businesses. We did this through the wage subsidy scheme and the various tax relief measures, of which the tourism industry accessed billions of dollars. Secondly, we are moving into a recovery and restart stage, extending the wage subsidy while we look at to help businesses pivot towards a domestic or trans-Tasman market, protecting strategic tourism assets and the communities that benefit from them, and easing into a domestic marketing campaign to get Kiwis to do something new, New Zealand. All the while keeping an eye on ensuring the tourism sector we are restarting and rebuilding is the reimagined industry we are planning for. The Tourism Task Force, which is a private public partnership will continue their work on providing that leadership and advice.
The Right Honourable Winston Peters.
Given that that misrepresentation or misinformation comes from a Member of Parliament and is against him and is wrong, does he expect now to receive an apology?
Oh, Mr. Speaker, no, I don't expect an apology from the opposition. I think they would be expecting way too much.
Committee coffee.
How important is Māori tourism in the recovery of the tourism industry?
Mr. Speaker, it's very important. We value the Māori contribution to our unique tourism offering. Mr. Speaker, in my list of priorities, I wouldn't rank the Māori contribution at number 13 or number 17. On this side of the House, our Māori contribution is more likely to have been seen at ranks number 2, 3, 11, 18, 20, 21, 22.
Have any coffee?
What alternative recovery plans has he seen for the tourism sector?
Mr. Speaker, our plan is to work with industry to respond, recover, restart and reimagine a better tourism industry than the one we had. This is much better than another plan I've seen which says we need to, and I quote, run a major advertising program, tell New Zealanders not to travel internationally and instead to visit bespoke destinations. You'll find this underwhelming plan if you go to www.national.org.nz.
Todd McClough.
Why, given that tourism was a $40 billion industry employing up to 400,000 people, did the budget only allocate 1% of that to help the tourism sector?
Well, Mr. Speaker, the Finance Minister was very specific in the budget speech that the after the initial response to COVID and the support that we gave to businesses, the budget was the second wave of support, and there will be a further wave of support. So the member just needs to sit and wait because more is to come.
The Right Honourable Winston Peters.
I can ask the Minister of Tourism, has he received any submissions on the future Māori contribution to New Zealand tourism from one Paora Heke Goldsmith?
I'd really be interested in any contribution from the Honourable Paora Kaura Mete, but to be honest,
Paul Goldsmith.
Seeing the policies from the other side, I don't have any anticipation that there'll be anything worthwhile and useful for the country.
When he says that the member should sit and wait, does he not realise he's saying to every single tourism business in New Zealand that actually they too must wait and that they need to urgently hear from him about what his actual plan is? They've now been waiting for more than 9 weeks.
Well, Mr. Speaker, the $400 million package is going to help businesses to pivot, to manage through to a potential trans-Tasman bubble or hibernate if that's what they need, or to explore other options, as well as the Strategic Assets Program, which will help those assets that have positive spillover effects not only beyond their own business but into their communities and into the wider region and potentially further afield. So, The budget announcement is good news for the tourism industry, and there is more good news to come.
Question number 12, Dr. Shane Retty.
Kia ora, Mr. Speaker. To the Minister of Employment, what employment programs or policies has he undertaken in response to the coronavirus outbreak?
The Honourable Retty.
Mr. Speaker.
Firstly, it's appropriate for me to acknowledge you.
Mr. Speaker, the first part of our response was to support workers and small business owners to keep people connected to their employment. Over $10 billion in wage subsidies to over 1.6 million Kiwis, and more than $890 million in small business loans to over 52,000 businesses to help with cash flow. We were in a strong position in terms of employment as we went into COVID-19 with the lowest general and Māori unemployment rates in a decade. We must protect those gains as much as possible. As part of our response, I have direct oversight, sir, of 5 critical programs that will help people, particularly young people and Māori, find jobs, learn new skills and tackle other barriers in terms of employment. We're expanding He Pautama Rangatahi, our community-driven employment program. We're investing in Māori apprenticeships, Māori trade training. We're strengthening our jobs and skill hubs in Auckland and we're working with and listening directly to our communities by establishing regional skills leadership groups, and we're expanding, sir, the very successful mana in mahi.
Supplementary. Is program completion an outcome measure for these programs, and if so, what are the targets for completion?
Mr. Speaker, in terms of the completion rates, we have had much success in that area. Much success. We have an 81% success rate in terms of mana and mahi. 81% success rate in terms of mana and mahi, sir. That's 81% of young people not returning to the unemployment benefit. So, of course, completion rates are important.
What are the completion rates for the other four programs that he's named in the House today?
In terms of He Potama Rangatahi, we have 3,000 young people who are involved in employment or in training. As I said, in terms of mana and mahi, we have an 81% success rate. Māori trade training has not yet started, but it will be very, very successful. Our jobs and skills hubs, sir, are working very well because they work in terms of the community, and our regional skills hubs also are working very, very well. All in all, sir, things are going very well in this area. We haven't given up like the opposition did after the GFC when unemployment spiralled to over 15%.
Supplementary, sir. How will increasing investment into He Potama Rangatahi improve employment outcomes for young people in response to COVID-19?
Mr. Speaker, by investing $121 million over 4 years with He Potama Rangatahi, we'll continue to fund community-driven programs that work with otherwise hard-to-reach young people who face multiple barriers to employment and training. This program up to now has been based out in the regions, but, sir, we'll be moving this program, still working in the regions where I work with the Honourable Shane Jones, but now moving this kaupapa into the cities. History shows us that young people are more strongly affected by economic crises, particularly young Māori, Pacific people, women and disabled people. These groups face difficulties getting employment, but also difficulties accessing training and education. He Potama Rangatahi programs can help them, sir, overcome these programs. This is a program we're very proud of, sir. The opposition talked about it when we came in 3 years ago, but never, ever rolled it out. And our communities they've benefited so greatly, and it's, of course, just a shame that COVID-19 came along.
Did he take any new employment programs or policies to Cabinet during the nearly 4 weeks of Alert Level 4, and if so, what were they?
Mr. Speaker, we had programs that were already in front of Cabinet, those programs have already done the business, already well established. So in terms of new programs, the only new program that was put forward was the Māori trade training program that we're hoping will be a big success, and the opposition should support also.
In light of all the discussions around Māori, the impacts of COVID-19 on Māori, how will investing in Māori apprenticeships improve employment outcomes for Māori in response to COVID-19?
Mr. Speaker, Māori have made great strides in the skills and employment outcomes in recent years, despite what the opposition did to them over the previous 9 years. And they need to be protected. Prior to COVID-19, we had seen the lowest unemployment rates for Māori in over a decade. So we must must protect those employment gains we've made and ensure Māori emerge from this crisis stronger than ever. That's why Budget 20, I should say. Oh, that was really funny, eh? Oh, right. Okay. Must be desperate if you found that funny, but the Māori Apprenticeship Fund, Mr. Speaker, The Māori Apprenticeship Fund will empower Māori entities to take on and support apprentices, such as through group trades training schemes to protect recent improvements in Māori skills and employment and strengthen the Māori Crown relationship. Our people are looking forward to the next few months, and although things are tough, there's a lot of optimism out there that they will form partnerships with a government that cares.
Entry. Of the 100 million coronavirus funding he announced on March 20 to redeploy workers due to coronavirus, how many have been redeployed?
I'll come back to you with that number.
That concludes oral questions.